House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Tuesday, February 16th, 2017. Today, we're going to be doing public hearings. I don't think we're going to move any to the work session. Okay, any of these bills. Work session, we'll open a hearing on House Bill 2218 and call Representative Wisnant, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2218 requires the Oregon State Police to include persons convicted of specifically identified sex crimes on the sex offender website.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, co-chairs Olson, and co-chairs Williamson, and honorable committee members. Who gets any pressure?
Oh, my gosh. This is so thick right now, Mr. Chair.
For the record, I'm Gene Wisnant, State Representative, House District 53, Sun River, Redmond, parts of Bend and Deschutes County. It's nice to be back in this committee, not on this side maybe, but I served three terms on this honorable committee under the chairmanship, vice chair of Chair Barker, McPherson, and Krieger. So. And I had the pleasure of then approving the money on the Ways and Means Public Safety Committees until this session. Chair, I'm here to propose House Bill 2218, which I submitted in the 2015 session, but did not make the cut of the informal sex offender work group chaired by Representative Williamson and Representative Taylor. However, during the interim, we had a meeting of the people on that task force, and we discussed other bills that we might look at in the future, and my bill was discussed and said, hey, that looks like a good bill, a good idea. One of the things I think the initial work group was concerned about is it wouldn't go beyond Oregon, but we found out once it's on the Oregon website, it will be picked up nationally. The LC drafter supported that, and I appreciated that. So first, let me briefly describe the background on why I submitted this bill. On a Christmas trip to New York City 2 years ago, Josie and I met a former New York police officer who was on the sex trafficking task force. He resigned from the New York Police Department and started a nonprofit working to stop sex trafficking. He explained he was disappointed that he found individuals involved in sex trafficking found guilty of these operations and went to prison, got out, and sometimes moved to a new state and started the business all over again under a new name and a new location. So he suggested I look into doing this, says at least the bill will hopefully put out information that will help citizens connect people with data and help these sex predators be identified and prevent them from starting a new operation if they had like they'd started before, and arrest them again to put them back where they belong. Nita Bells, I think this committee's heard from her before, the director of the human trafficking in our backyard, and she's actually based in Redmond, had a conflict and was not able to come testify in support of this bill today. But you have her letter of support, and I think two other letters of support on OLIS that I would appreciate you reading. I'll just comment from Nita, because she has such credibility in this issue, is she's reported that the list of registered sex offenders are available in other places. She knows this. However, I see no harm in increasing the availability of that information and additional resources. I think some of the opposition you're going to hear today is the fact that it may not really help, but honorable committee members, our job is to prevent crime, and we want to help those. We want to not have people commit the crime again, but if we know they're out there doing it again, I see no harm in passing this bill. There's no cost to it, there's no revenue impact, and there's no financial impact. So, Mr. Chair, again, thank you for hearing the bill, and I urge you to pass it, and I'm available for questions.
Okay, if you have a few more minutes, I'll have Ms. Van Order come up, and then if there's any questions together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just until the lady sits down.
Remember to identify yourself for the record. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Christine Van Order, and I'm from Gladstone, Oregon. And I am here to testify in support of this bill because I just came from a criminal justice summit, justice reinvestment summit, and I was talking to people from other states, and they could not believe the pathetic state that our sex offender website was in. And I just feel like this is an important issue that single moms need to know who they're dating. I just had a recent issue. I had to notify a mom that her boyfriend was a predator, convicted predator, and she didn't believe me because if it was that bad, he'd be on the website, right? And because he wasn't, she didn't believe that he targets girls the same age as her daughters. And so I feel that we have a duty to protect every single person in this state from people that are convicted of certain crimes. And I think that we need to use the technology because an informed public is a safer public. So I just hope that you will pass this and maybe even expand it, give it some muscles.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Representative Ms. Van Order? Thank you.
Yeah. I just wanted to. Okay. So, Gene, really quick, how many other states are doing something similar to this?
I have not checked into that, Mr. Chair, Representative Olson. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Okay. Thank you.
I can check into it, Mr. Chair. We have that for your work session.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Marilyn Madison, Gail Meyer, and Kimberly McCullough.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I'd like to start by just framing the issue, and then I'll get into the specifics of this bill. First of all, I'd just like to say that we take gender-based and sexual violence extremely seriously, and we do think that this body should do everything within its power to prevent those things. But we should also do that in a way that is effective and that doesn't actually cause unintended consequences and harm that more harm than good. Because of our concerns about effectiveness and unintended consequences, we oppose the use of sex offender websites entirely. We do understand why these websites have taken root in this country. It may seem intuitive at first glance to think if the public knows who's been convicted of a sex offense, that that's somehow going to keep us safer. But unfortunately, our instincts aren't always correct, and that's why we should strive to enact policy that is rooted in public safety evidence and research. We should also take care that the solutions we come up with don't have unintended consequences. This is one of those circumstances. Sex offender websites do not actually improve public safety, but instead have many downsides. It is true that law enforcement, knowing, having a registry, and knowing who sex offenders are, can help keep the public safe by keeping law enforcement abreast of the presence of high-risk individuals. But these public websites actually cause a huge amount of harm by promoting vigilante justice. What we know is that these websites put targets on people's backs, and there are folks in our society who will then go and harm those individuals, which then has additional negative impacts on our society. There's no due process in vigilantism. There's no proportionality in the way people are treated and the crimes they've committed. There's no refocus on rehabilitation. In short, there's none of the values that are central to our justice system. So that's the framing. So I realize that our position is not necessarily a popular one. And because of that, we understand that Oregon is likely to continue to use these websites. In light of that, we would urge you to at least use these websites in such a way where it is based on an individualized assessment of the risk of that individual of reoffending. What this bill does is it makes the inclusion of certain individuals in the website mandatory based on crime category rather than an individualized risk assessment. We previously used a crime category system before this legislature, in its wisdom, decided to move to a risk-based system. a person with a high risk of reoffending may actually be convicted of a low crime category. Similarly, a person with a low risk of reoffending may have a conviction in a higher crime category. It's actually that second category that's going to be impacted by this bill. So just to explain the mechanics, under current law, a person who is assessed as high risk must be on the website. So the only people that this is going to add to the website are people who have been assessed, and they have been assessed as low risk. But they're just going to be in there because of their crime category, as opposed to this assessment that is evidence-based and has been developed in order to make this whole system more effective. So the other reason we're very concerned about this is that if this legislature enacts this exception, we're concerned that this is just going to be a slippery slope to adding more and more and more exceptions until the exceptions swallow the rule and we end up with the old system, which we moved away from for good reasons. So rather than heading in that direction, we urge you to shift to a different policy question entirely, which is whether these websites should be maintained. And we hope that you will at least look into the evidence about that issue. So thank you.
Okay, so you want to go to the panel and go, and then we'll ask questions.
Thank you. Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. It feels as though we're back in 2011 when Senate Bill 67 came up for hearing before the House Judiciary Committee. Senate Bill 67 passed the House, the Senate rather, 30-0, and it landed in front of this committee. And what it did was it authorized the Oregon State Police to make available by electronic query information on the internet, information on the registry. And what would have happened from that is third-party data mining entities and organizations would have come in, basically scooped it out by zip code, and have put the entirety of the website, of the registry rather, up on a website, up on some third-party internet website. What happened in 2011 is the co-chairs, who at the time there was a split house, the co-chairs were Wayne Krieger and Representative Barker, put a stop to that bill. And they said, we're going to take a look at what we do with the registry because this is a huge quagmire and we want to make sure we do it right before we put all of it up there. And so that then led to this work group from 2011 until 2013. This was one of the most hardworking work groups consisting of people with diverse expertise that I've had the privilege of ever attending. But in came everybody involved with this process, prosecutors, defense lawyers, judges, most particularly DOC and community corrections. And it was the SOSIN, the Sex Offender Supervision Network, which is this coordinated network of community-based supervision people who supervise sex offenders in the state of Oregon. SOSIN put on the table the proposal that we take our sex offender registry and we convert it into a tiered registry based on individualized assessments of individual risk. What is the risk of reoffense of this one individual? And that that would be the paradigm by which the entire registry would be controlled. We heard over and over again from people who had expertise that a conviction-based registry is just not the right way to go. It is over-inclusive and it is under-inclusive. You can have people convicted of misdemeanors who are very high risk. You can have people convicted of A felonies who are not. And the question really for law enforcement in the field when they encounter someone who's on the registry, or for people cohabitating side by side as neighbors, who's the high-risk person and who's the low-risk person, and give the people, law enforcement as well as the public, accurate information about their level of individualized risk. And we heard over and over and over again, a conviction-based system might be quick, might be easy, might be cheap, but it was not the way to go. That work group resulted in a proposal of 2013-2549, which is still in the process of being implemented by the board. It's a lengthy process, but it is taking our registry and converting it into tiers of risk based on individualized assessments. I would like to alert the committee, Oregon has one of the biggest, broadest registry requirements of any in the nation. We require youth to register, we require people to register based on misdemeanors, and we require people to register for a presumptive lifetime registration. That's not the case in many states. Many states are felonies only, many states are adults only, many states are also, again, based on conviction, you're on for a certain number of years, and then you're off. For it's a common paradigm, you register for C felony, you're off at 10, presuming no further problems, no further contacts. You register for a B felony, you're off at 15. You register on a felony, you're off at 20. That's a very common paradigm. Oregon's different. We have presumptive lifetime registration for misdemeanors on up. And that is leading to this gluttonous registry that just keeps growing. So the idea was to convert to a tiered system based on individualized risk, and this came to the work group by and through the supervision network that was responsible for supervising these folks. So what this bill attempts to do here, we think, is very similar to what was before the committee in 2011. Should we just allow people to have information based on certain crimes? And we would ask this committee to please hit the pause button before it reverses all the hard and good work that was done that led up to 2549 and which is still being in the process of being implemented. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Madison, please.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair Barker and the committee, for allowing me to speak because this affects me directly.
And you need to identify yourself for the record.
Oh, Marlene Madison, and I live in Salem, Oregon.
Thank you.
And I am against the any registry except through the state police, I think. But this is my story. HB 2218 is dangerous public notification law to pass. It has put registrants and families in extreme danger. There have been many vigilante murders from people that found addresses on the internet and came to a person's house and killed the husband and wife. In dozens of years, we've had vigilante murders in Washington State, Maine, and South Carolina. These states have publicly listed names and addresses of those on the registry. That were murdered have been living ordinary lives and not harming anyone. Vigilantes are born out of media coverage, constantly repeating the same crimes over and over. That builds unnecessary fear, disgust, and rage. It gives these people and the public the understanding that these crimes happen constantly, when in fact they are extremely rare and considered black swan events. This is the stranger danger. This also removes rational critical thought. I have added to the system empirical studies on the huge impact of media. It's an enormous study that I had uploaded on media and how it has affected criminal justice legislation over the last 30 years. We need to get back to the rational, practical legislation that protects everyone and go back to restorative justice system that is so much better than barbaric constant punishing system we now have in place. The fact that the registrants have extremely low reoffense rates and a large multi-state study showed that reoffense rates are not only low for sex offenders at the low tiers, but they have no difference in the higher tiers classification in determining who would reoffend. All groups of registered sex offenders have extremely low reoffense rates. Those rates are low, as this means in committing another sex offense. They may be arrested for not registering, but that is not a dangerous offense. Those rates are so low as to be at least as low or lower than the general public. This shows how irrational the registry has always been. This study proved that it did not matter what the previous sex offense was in prior years in regards to reoffending and committing sex crimes. All categories were extremely low. The result of this study give question to what could possibly be pushing the ever-expanding legislation on those that have already paid their debt to society and have extremely low reoffense stats across the board. The multi-state study on what results would be gained with a tier program were compared over the years to see if there was any difference in reoffending. They compared these states in one large study, and it showed that the tier system was absolutely of no benefit. This program created more state expense that could have been more useful in other ways in the state. The static 99 test score and tier program showed it is not effective because across the board, all sex offenders have low reoffense rates and are very unlikely to reoffend or have low reoffense rates no matter what their crime was previously. The only issue that was significant in this study was those with personality disorders such as psychopathic tendencies that could act out again. This did not affect the fact the huge number in the studies do not have those personality disorders. I think that all citizens that are not, and not just some citizens, need to feel safe, and that the state job is to legislate to not put some citizens in danger while only giving imaginary safety to the other group. Some registrants have family members, and their children will suffer more if neighbors find out that they have a registrant in the family. The children could be outcast with the other children. They may suffer taunting and bullying. Our neighbors could come and harass us, and we may feel unsafe walking down the street. Some could come to our home and shoot us because they found our address in a listing. People that see sex offender addresses see all of them dangerous and the same. They see them as what is portrayed on television and in motion pictures. We do not have a balance in justice because biases are permitted and cherished in sex crime cases. The evidence and the vast number of empirical and scientific research has been ignored, and only emotional, illogical, political motivation has expanded the sex offender legislations. The victim is given a sacred place and the accused is given a demon status. This creates the foundation of the injustice and the lack of the Sixth Amendment's rights lost to the overreaching powers of the prosecutor, Measure 11 crimes, and the power of coerced plea agreement arrangements. The television broadcasting crime shows have damaged criminal justice system by creating such bias as to make it almost impossible to find a jury that can listen to evidence in sex offense trials. Those accused of a sex offense are considered guilty by accusation. I have suffered because of these laws, and personally, as my daughters and my granddaughters watch crime television, they have not spoken to me in 8 years. I have suffered emotional grief from the loss of my family. And because of these have seen several counselors. I am again seeing a doctor over this bill as I worry about it. This is, there is no greater pain than losing your children or grandchildren on manufactured fears. I am just one of many people that suffer like this. Please consider this bill as dangerous and unfair, unnecessary bill that could create the possibility of harm coming from Oregonians just trying to live a normal life and be part of the community we all share. Our national crime rates, with numbers comparable in 61, thank you. We have far more people in this country too. We're very safe, but the perception does not match the facts. We need to move the stress and burden of fear from the public on stranger danger and educate on the reality of how safe we are in communities. My research is in uploaded. And I want to say one more thing here, a quote. We go against the dominant thinking of your friends, of most of people you see every day, is perhaps the most difficult action of heroism you can perform. And in something like this that has become popular, sometimes you have to step out and do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Question, Representative Olson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, Gail, you mentioned Senate Bill 67 back in 2011. I remember that bill quite well, too. And when it came over here, I was glad what the co-chairs did with that. 2549 that we worked on, I remember that one quite well, too. My question from you is, as we moved forward with the three-tier situation with that, do you see this slowly developing into an effective process compared to where it was?
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, I am on the implementation team for 2549, having been it's a subset of the Governor's Reentry Council. There have been some challenges with the board in implementing 2549. Part of it is that the board, the parole board today, is brand new, and they didn't participate in the work group that led up to 2549. And the implementation team is giving feedback to the board. Your procedures aren't in alignment with what the work group was foreseeing would occur in terms of importing existing static 99 scores, et cetera. So I'm happy to say this. I hope I'm answering your question. There's going to be a reconvening of the original work group of those people that were there because we feel like we need to communicate to the board. The board inherited a really long bill, but they didn't participate in its enactment, right? And it's hard to upload all of the thinking of the experts that were in the room. So that meeting is now hopefully going to be occurring very quickly. But I think the board is reexamining its original assumptions of having to redo an assessment on everyone when the truth of it is DOC and Community Corrections already have existing assessments done on people that are coming out of DOC and people who are currently on supervision. So that's a good half of the registry right there. So in answer to your question, Representative Olson, I do think that there's going to be progress that people are going to start seeing really soon.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up? So, Kimberly, I know you haven't been in our state all that long or anything like that, but you did throw out the term vigilante. Are you aware of any instances here in Oregon?
I haven't actually done research specifically on Oregon, but I have seen all sorts of evidence of it happening around the country. So I can't imagine that it would be much different. But yeah, I can look into that and see if I can find something for you.
Okay.
Yeah. We were actually, and we're not even on the registry. I don't know how the person found our number, but we were called when we lived in Gresham, and it was constant. The guy would not stop calling us and harassing us, and I didn't know if he lived in the area or what. I was kind of afraid, so I called the police. And even when the police officer showed up, he was ringing, and we gave the phone to him. And he did handle the call, and the guy did not call back. But
it's a good choice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, with Gail Meyer and Representative Olson, lived through 2549, and it was quite the overhaul of the system that we worked with the state police as well. Gail didn't mention that, but as managers of the registry, and really trying to manage resources, the idea of moving to an evidence-based registry where they could allocate their resources, their supervision resources appropriately was part of I would say modernizing our registry was all about. So I just wanted to mention that because they were a party that Gail didn't mention. For those of you who were here in 2013, that's when we passed 2549, but in 2015, we updated 2549 for technical fixes. So this body is continuing to work for the smooth implementation of a fundamentally different kind of registry that all the law enforcement that we worked with in crafting 2549 were begging us for, because they had this huge registry and had no ability to figure out where to put their resources because it was a conviction-based registry, and that didn't tell them enough to know whether or not they should be supervising people at various levels. And so the implementation, as far as I know Gail's more involved than I am, is going along fairly smoothly. I mean, it's a big project, so but they continue to bring back to this body technical fixes to make it go to make the process smoother. So I would I don't think we have any bills, technical bills, yet this session on the registry, but we didn't, we had a big bill in 2015 to make sure that the process would move along in a timely manner.
Thank you. Representative Springer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Kimberly, I want to confirm what I thought I heard. You say that registries don't keep people any safer.
Not that Chair Barker and Representative Springer, that the websites don't keep people safer. The registry being in the hands of law enforcement is a totally separate issue from the website being published for the public.
Mr. Chair, do we have any studies or evidence of that one way or the other?
I can forward you some materials that I have, yeah.
That supports that claim?
Yes.
Okay, good. I'd like to see that.
Representative Gorsuch, were you have a question? Representative Post, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably both questions I think were kind of answered, but I just want to make sure that I mention this. Kimberly, both you and Gail, the two things that stuck out was vigilantism, data mining. I think it's already been asked. I would love to see some numbers on the percentage of vigilantism that's happened in America and in Oregon specifically, because that was your lead, vigilantism, which is a big headline and very scary. And I kind of don't like that kind of lead. I'd like to see numbers. If we're going to say vigilantism, I want to see some, because that's a very scary proposition. And if it's not a huge number, that bothers me a lot, because I know there are a number of sex offenders. And there are a huge number of traffickers in Oregon right now, and that really bothers me, the amount of human trafficking that's going on. And if I can give the police and the general public a tool, I'm going to give them that tool. So it's not a question, I'm sorry, it's a statement. But to lead with vigilantism and data mining compared to human trafficking and sex offenders, I'm having a hard time with that. And frankly, I don't know who put this thing out, but that it's fascist, I don't know who did this. But this is garbage. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Chair,
yes.
I have one more thought. I don't speak for anybody except for myself. I will say that a common discussion, though, during the work group with respect to, again, there's the registry. There's the registry being available to law enforcement. Then there's the registry being available to the public and then having it on the internet. So there was all that continuum being discussed. A couple things were observed repeatedly. Number one, those who were supervising sex offenders wanted to be very careful in calibrating public notification on the internet to those people who truly were dangerous, because the impact of having someone on the internet was very destabilizing for that offender. They very frequently would lose their place of residing. And I mean, sometimes mothers would say to them, you're going to have to move out because I have to worry about the other kids at home, you're right? And they would very often lose their jobs. And so it was very destabilizing for an offender to be on the internet. And to that effect, there was an understanding that let's make sure this is calibrated now to those folks who really, truly are dangerous, and it's a public safety service to give the public information about this person, but not that person. And so that was the focus. And that's why there was a rejection of the conviction-based model, because the conviction of itself was not very indicative of the level of risk of reoffense of that person. So that's why it was the experts, again, who came to the table with this tiered-based system. The other thing is, please understand that law enforcement always has access to this. I mean, if they encounter somebody in the field and they do a record check, they're going to know this person has a prior conviction for a prior crime. It doesn't have to be on the internet. They have access to the registry at large. What we heard from law enforcement was, we would really like to know when I encounter this person in the field, who am I dealing with? If I'm responding to a noisy party violation at night thing, and I'm starting to do ID checks, and I see that there's a party going on in a house, and somebody I'm checking is a prior conviction, give me information. Is this a low-risk guy? Is this a high-risk guy? I need to know if there's other people in that house I need to be worried about or not. And so law enforcement also wanted the individualized risk assessment indication for them, because they can't tell when they encounter somebody, high risk, low risk, what am I dealing with here? So that's not a direct response to anything you said, but it was an indication that those folks who really did have public safety in mind were of the view that a tiered system based on individualized risk is the best way to go. That was the best practice.
So we have been talking about the registration in the Public Safety Ways and Means Subcommittee at the present time. It was scheduled to be done. We were hoping to have it done in 2019. They're not going to have it done. They're still working on that. And we're learning on the stat, I think stat 99, is that the correct? So that where it seems like DOC is taking a three-hour time window to conduct that and getting the results, the people that are doing it for the parole board, the psychologists, are taking many, many hours at very high expense, and so it's a very slow process, but it's important. And when the vigilantism thing, I also would like to see some numbers on that. We have 28,000 people right now, which is a lot of people on that list, and how many vigilante, and then also the degree of it, because a phone call is different from an assault. And I understand the nuisance of phone calls, because I get them partly because of this job and I had them in my other job. And as far as the public being able to know, there was a fairly prominent person in Portland that worked with the homeless community who was a sex predator. And it wasn't well known. I mean, I knew it because I was a cop. And so one day my wife says, oh, wonderful news. So-and-so, the homeless advocate's going to come speak at our daughter's middle school. And I said, something. I said, no, he isn't. And then I went to the principal and said, this guy, and I told him. And then it wasn't too much later than that, the Willamette Week published, and the guy left town. But anyway, so it is important that the public would know some of those people. I think his predatory level is high that you would not object to him being on a list. Maybe you would. But those are the kind of things and that are of great concern. And people are concerned, and they're worried about, wouldn't want to send my children to somebody's house with the older brother that's a pedophile if I didn't. I wouldn't send them if I knew about it, but I certainly would want to know about it. Those are the kind of things as a dad that I would want to know. So, okay, thank you. No further questions for this group. Thank you, panel, and I will call Tom Madison and Ken Noly, please. Please go ahead, just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Tom Madison. I'm from Salem. I am a registered citizen here in Oregon. That's my identifier. For people that don't know, of course, I explain further, that means I'm on the sex offender registry here in Oregon. So it's good to be here. Chairman Barker, thank you for having me today, and ladies and gentlemen of the House Judiciary Committee. You know, I could be affected by this HB 2218. I can't say for sure. I've weighed my minds and I'm going back and forth on it, but I wanted to be here today to add some comments to it and maybe get some questions from you as I go through some of the notes I have in front of me. I was convicted in the year 2000 of sex abuse having to do with prostitution. I was given a 5-year probation, and turns out the only time I've ever had a run-in with the law was in that same year, that same event. So I've never had a criminal conviction before the year 2000, and I haven't had one after that either. I've also been a political activist working around the country, but mostly here in Oregon. This is my home state, but I have been vigorous in fighting against registry laws across the board, everywhere from Florida to Washington State, California, New York recently. So I take a lot of pride in that. I have quite a bit of knowledge on it. I can't say that I've got perfect knowledge. There's a lot of things to talk about. Maybe I'll get back to that vigilante question that popped up in the last session. But whenever I hear that the Oregon legislature is convening to do business, you know, I get a knot in my stomach. I ask myself, what are they going to do to me now? It's always something going on. And I got to think about that. You know, why should I have to worry about that? I mean, if my debt is paid, why should it matter that I have to worry about crimes committed by other people? Oh, but then they're put into my group, and as a group, well, we're held accountable. I'm never individually held accountable, but we're held accountable as a group, and I find that very disturbing. And that's why I work against these laws, plus the notification laws that go with the registration. For a large number of registered sex offenders in our state who have completed their debts to society for past wrongs, the continuing flow of legislative assaults against us is maddening and depressing. It is as if our local government is on a never-ending crusade to push us all towards banishment, family breakups and divorce, unemployment and homelessness, and possibly increased victimization from vigilantism, unemployment and homelessness, and possibly increased homelessness to more serious things as to possibly even ultimately committing suicide for some of us on the registry. I certainly know about that. Which is regardless of our good citizenship track, our lawfulness over the years that we are on this, sometimes years, sometimes decades, but it just never ends. So why were we left out of being given a fresh start and to be able to be reintegrated back into society as former prisoners at the time we were released? Why are we on a list at all? Why are we on this, what I call this, government blacklist? Why are we being held up for? I'll get to that in a moment. Today's bill, HB 2218, intends to add more of us to an ever-growing public scarlet letter notification system. This is on top of a life sentence on Oregon's registry database. I sometimes have joked that the registry and notification laws in our state should be called the Oregon Sex Offender Persecution, Oppression, Orwellian Blacklist for Second-Class Citizens of the Formerly Convicted of Sex Offenders. In all seriousness, about HB 2218, are there any studies that show that a program of this sort, in that of it being a public humiliation type of website, does any good? What will HB 2218 do to the existing fragile living circumstances of Oregon's registered families whose lives are already devastated by registration law? Is there ever going to be an end to the registration nightmare that keeps our families under constant duress and poverty? How many more government legal assaults against our freedoms and liberties must we bear in the years ahead? When can we ever be free again? Last fall, in the heat of the 2016 election frenzy, we heard unusual new terms being tossed about by the national media mostly, fake news and fake facts. Many articles have been written pointing out that our sex offender registration and notification laws are out of sync with reality because they are based on, some say, irrational fears, myths, emotional outrage and disgust, exaggerations and anger, and most of all, maybe someone would call it a political lust for more punishment beyond the prison sentence. Given that description, I think it is fair to say that the sex offender registration and notification laws do have their roots in this era of fake news and fake facts as inputs that lead us eventually to come up with a system of pre-crime management and ultimately databases and public notification. Regardless of what influenced HB 2218's development was, the question now is, How is it adding, helping by adding more registered citizens' faces onto the OSP website, and how does it offer greater public safety? Because I know that there is no evidence of the public notifications to stop sex crimes, except in the rarest and most extreme examples. Again, and if I could have some water, I apologize. My throat is about to go.
I'll get it for you.
Sorry, thank you.
Thank you.
With that said, HB 2218, its creator was highly likely to have had the old view of the stranger danger myth in mind, even though that particular myth has been debunked many, many times. But here goes something like this. The term stranger danger, which is used frequently in the debates about sex offender studies, has historically been proven to be a huge exaggeration of an extremely rare event in which a registered sex offender, a stranger, seeks out and makes contact with a stranger child to him. Government statistics prove that this is a very rare, and if this rare stranger danger child abuse assault should never happen, it will likely not be at a registrant's home. So having the address, having the picture on the website, having parents knowledgeable about that blue house down the street, that's where that registered sex offender lives, well, what good does it do? Do registered citizens have cars? Can they get on airplanes? Can they go other places? It seems to me it's a useless law in the first place. Again, it is important to point out that according to federal and state studies, most child sex abuse happens within a range of already known persons within circles of families, friends, and closely connected others. That's around 94% from what I see in the statistics. It has also been proven that the vast number of new sex crimes will be committed by first-timer sex offenders entering the system for the first time. They are, of course, not yet registered offenders. The irrational worries built into HB 2218 provides several very negative side effects that will further cripple Oregon's registered families. Just like its parent, the sex offender registration law itself, HB 2218 will recklessly increase the dangers of registered families who are and soon to be publicly exposed by OSP's notification website. Our families do not need more negative attention brought to our law-abiding families. Nobody needs newly stirred up public hysteria, vigilantism, and harassment. In summary, HB 2218 is bad for Oregon because it operates under the false pretense that putting more registered citizens' faces on a government-run public website is a good thing for greater public safety for Oregonians. This is simply false. Instead, the bill will further cheat parents and their children by misdirecting their attention towards registrants on the database instead of the place where the vast majority of these crimes occur. And as I've said before, that's in the family. It's the spouses, it's the children, the older siblings, maybe it's the coach down at the high school. But it's not usually going to be that stranger sex offender that's going to somehow find connection with your child. Media fake news and previously debunked political fake facts have not served Oregon's efforts at public safety except to drive up the cost of government while further destroying more and more lives of the now more than 28,000 registered citizens in our state. This has made Oregon number one in per capita rankings of sex offender populations. Compare this to the state of Ohio, for example, with a general population there of about four times what Oregon's population is in general, but yet both states have roughly equal registrant numbers. So it is recommended in Oregon that Oregon legislatures focus their future efforts on two main goals. One is to require sex offender registration requirements for only those on probation and parole. And if you've completed your obligations to the state, why should you not be a free citizen again? Most sex offenders have very low reoffense rates anyway. Why would that be a concern to anyone? And secondly, recommend that OSP's public notification website be shut down for good and only be used and only be responsible for maintaining the database of registrants as per item number one. It is time to stop this political bloodlust and hatred of this registered families in our state. It is time to move past the current age we live in, this great age, this great sex panic era that we live in. And let's use real facts, not guessing, not rumor, not emotions, in the creation of our new sex offender laws in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I got to jump in here on this,
okay,
if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
So, Tom, you threw a whole bunch of descriptives out there. And, I mean, I just got to ask you a few questions here.
Sure.
We know that Portland has become one of the top sex trafficking hubs in the nation. And the focus on it has been basically with underage girls. We know that for the sexual exploitation. This bill on page 2 talks specifically trafficking persons under this section for dealing with sex trafficking. And the other person is under age 18 is what the focus is. The second part of that is obviously compelling prostitution. Tell me how you see with what we're trying to do with, or what Representative Wisnett is trying to do here with this bill, one, how it is recklessly endangering families, since that's how you described it, and the second thing is how it's impacting law-abiding families when they're in violation of law.
Well, first of all, if you're talking about the enforcement of the law itself, then go for that. I mean, if laws are being broken.
I'm talking specifically about what I just asked you about, that section of this bill. I'm not talking about the generality of the sex offender registration program. I'm talking specifically about this. This is what I'm asking you, because you didn't even address this.
Well, maybe go at it again. Rephrase that, please.
Well, you mean for the whole question?
No, just boil down what you're trying to get to.
Well, okay, so I've already explained that Portland has become one of the number one sex trafficking cities in the country. What are they going after? It's underage girls. I want to know from you, because you said it, this bill is going to recklessly endanger families,
mm-hmm,
and also it's going to impact law-abiding families. I want to know how that applies to that piece.
I misunderstood you. And what I was getting at is registered families, in other words, people on the sex offender registry. I thought you were referring to new crimes being committed. Those people on the registry, people like myself, I heard my wife a little while ago, we as a family are impacted by these laws, and it impacts many of the registered families throughout Oregon. A registered family is a family with obviously one registered sex offender as a member of that family, and it brings harm to them when a registrant can't find employment, a registrant loses housing, and the family loses housing as a result of being kicked out by the landlord, for example. Any number of other sociological factors that cause banishment of a sort, being pushed out of the margins.
Mr. Chair, he's not answering my question.
Yeah, he's not going to, probably. So. Why don't we go ahead and do that, and we'll
thank you anyway.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I appreciate the chance to visit with you again. My name is Ken Nolley. I'm a retired Willamette University professor, and I work with Oregon Voices. We're a group who advocate for evidence-based practices in dealing with sex offender laws. I've written a letter to the committee that was carefully thought through, and I won't try to duplicate everything I've said. I would like to kind of respond in the context of the discussion that's taken place, and maybe even to some of the questions that have been asked. One of the things I'd like to stress, because I realize some people on the committee weren't here in 2013 or in 2015, and maybe a few more things about what 2549 meant. And I should also say I served on the task force that drafted the original bill. And like Gail, I also serve with the implementation committee working with the parole board. So I've thought about these issues a lot and am pretty deeply involved in that process. One of the things I wanted to stress, because I don't think this has been made clear yet, is that the risk-based system that 2549 puts into place is not an either-or, an on-off switch in terms of notification. The people who are listed as high risk will be placed on the registry, public registry, and that group is substantially larger than the group who are currently listed as predatory. The current predatory designation is a crime-based designation. One of the concerns of the parole board in dealing with the where they started in doing risk-based statics for people who hadn't had them done yet, they started with the predatory people partly because they realized there were many people listed as predatory who did not represent high risk. So that category is going to be rethought substantially, and will refigure the registry. No one knows exactly how large that group will be, but out of the 29,000 people, it's assumed that perhaps 7,000, something like that, will be listed as high risk. So there'll be many, many more names on that public registry than are now there. And these are people who will have had statics done on them. If you're listed as high, it's not only that you're listed on the public registry, but there are a large number of people who are associated with your lives and who are around you who will be notified. I wish I could remember exactly what all of those are in each of the three tiers. If you're level two, it's a smaller, more circumscribed list who will be notified. If you're level one, it's a very small list, but still people who are most intimately involved with registrants will get notified. It's not there's notification or there's not notification. I think that this part of the process has been thought through really, really quite carefully. Also, just a quick sideline. I don't know, Representative Post, of any overall statistics on vigilanteism. The study that I recommended to the committee has looked at a lot of that data, but the study doesn't list numbers. But they say it's a very small percentage. It's not very high. I personally have only seen in the news three cases. But I have to say, if among the families who have a family member on the registry, these things, you can imagine, are like a bolt of lightning. People are really afraid of them. I only know of one incident in Oregon of somebody who was involved with Oregon Voices whose house was shot at repeatedly, and he finally moved out of state because he found that difficult for obvious reasons. But that's the only case I know of vigilanteism in Oregon. There may be others, but that's all I can cite. I did want to try to provide a quick overview of what I summarized quickly in the letter, though, about the studies. And this is all, I thought, this is a very complicated field. I'm an academic, and my feeling is if I've read lots and lots of studies, how can I give something that makes sense to you? And this, to me, is the most comprehensive and most careful overall look that I know of, looking at the specific issue of public notification as an effective device at reducing sex crimes. Most of the studies began as early as 1995, and for years these studies were being done. In those days, all the registries that they were looking at were crime-based, and they were looking, and many states were putting everybody up on the registry. So you had a different kind of cohort than you might have in other kind of studies later. Those studies, over and over and over again, showed no reduction in sex crimes, no change whatsoever. More recently, and this is kind of fascinating, and I should back up and say some of those studies, and we're only talking about very small percentages here, some of those studies actually showed a slight increase in recidivism. There's no one who can say exactly why that's the case, but the statistics I gave you in the letter, about 30% of people on public registries report that they have lost jobs, 10 to 20% have lost housing. I think the percentage was 44% have had harassment. Those are all risk factors for reoffense. And this may have to do with why there are slight increases in recidivism when that's true. But more recently, there have been some different studies involving different cohorts. And a few of those studies, and the document I sent to you is very cautious about that. It says it needs more study. They're not sure they're willing to draw conclusions from it yet. But they see perhaps a slight increase in deterrence with online registration. But all of these studies that showed that slight deterrent effect were of registries that only listed the level one offenders. And the writers of the article theorize that this may well be that the gains are best, at largest, in that group. You have, you're not taking a risk of destabilizing people who were otherwise well on a way to build, rebuilding a productive and healthy life. That's what I can see in the studies. And to some degree, this is, you know, the legislation bothers me because it doesn't seem to me that it's going to achieve a lot in terms of what its goals are. What worries me much more is the thing that I think Gail stressed, is that this will not be the last time we see this. If this bill passes, there will be more and more bills. There are lots of sex crimes that disgust us all appropriately. None of us wants to see trafficking. None of us wants to see compelled prostitution. These are disgusting things. And there are plenty of other sex crimes that will revolt all of us. But making this decision over and over again, each time we do it, we undermine what was, I think, a well-thought-out proposal in 2013. And if we can get this back on track, I agree with Gail's assessment of where things are. I think that slowly the parole board is getting up to speed with the intent of the committee, and I think there's a chance that things are going to speed up substantially. If we can do that, I think there's a real chance we will see progress that we won't see, I'm afraid, by going back. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Corsick.
Professor, if I can ask you a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the assertions that have been made about the low likelihood of reoffending. And I believe it was said earlier that only folks that had severe mental issues would be likely to continue offending. Would you agree with that? What is your opinion on that? Yeah. How's that?
This is all, there's a lot of opinion in all of these things. And those of us who are dealing with sex offenders and are trying to advocate for some different practices, we're fond of citing recidivism statistics, but they're complicated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why one has to be careful in how one treats them. Most states report recidivism on a three-year basis. So when they say there's a certain crime has a certain recidivism rate, that recidivism rate is calculated over a three-year period. Now, it's clear that that's lower than it will be likely to be over a six-year period or a 10-year period. But since that's a standard reporting time, it's the one that's often used. When you have three-year reporting times, those rates have come down. Actually, let me back up. Another complication is when we say recidivism, what do we mean? Does it mean committing another sex crime? That's what we usually think of that meaning. Most often, it doesn't mean that. It means another arrestable offense or at least a felony, but it may not be a sex crime. Now, that should be of concern to us, but if those rates are pushed up by those other things, that may not be the most important thing on our mind. Sometimes recidivism is counted as having been sent back to prison. That could be for a parole violation, but it might be a relatively minor thing. In some places, people have been sent back to jail for not having housing. But that's a kind of odd violation. In Marion County, I'm told by the people who work for Jeff Wood, that Jeff Wood's crew, I've talked to them, and they say somewhere around 15% to 20% of the people on supervision who are on the registry in Marion County are homeless. I also work with people who are at UGM who are homeless, trying to help them find housing, and it's a terribly difficult thing. But that may be counted as recidivism in some kind of count. So these are really difficult numbers. But the numbers I've seen that look most trustable in recent years have often been in the 2% to 3% range, and lower than any other category of crime. I don't want to try to hold any single number up as being completely meaningful.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken, thank you for your testimony. I appreciate that it's research-based. So you cited this Lasher and McGrath study in your letter. Is that where you get – I'm not asking – definitively, is that where you're getting the bulk of the recommendations, the research that you've been citing today?
Not really, but it Representative Springer, but it is. I thought if I was going to write to the committee, it was good to have a single set of data.
Yes, it is.
And this data, I would say, is. If you take the time to read the article, and I would say some of it is really heavily wonky on statistics, and I'm an English professor, so my eyes glaze over in those pages too. The early part of the report is a summary of the research. It's very readable, and it can give you a lot of this information that comes from many, many different studies. They then take eight studies that have data, and they collate that data to come up with the numbers. When I was quoting numbers for you in there, that comes from their reworking and then collating these eight different studies.
Thank you. Follow-up? Just an additional comment, Mr. Chair. We've heard lots of really inflammatory adjectives here today. And I would bring us back as nobody feels good about suicide, nobody feels good about a lot of these comments that have been made. And whether I like this bill or I don't like this bill, whether I like a registry or I don't like a registry, I want to bring us back, and I've been sitting here reminding myself of this point, I want to bring myself back to this one point is I'm not diminishing the value of any bad things that occur to somebody that's on the sex offense registry. However, I would add to that also that nobody's on that registry without a crime being committed. And so I don't know that we can blame every bad thing on the registry. There's other factors there. Maybe it's just the registry, maybe it's not. But I think we've missed a lot of factors that go into this conversation before we have even a registry.
Thank you. Representative Stark, I'll go to you in a minute here. I just want to add on to that. We've had victims up here. We've had victims of the church rapes of those priests. We've had women victims of rape. We've had people have been molested as a child. As a cop, one of my worst nights ever was when a 9-month-old was raped, and I could hardly wait to get home to open the bottle of scotch that night. I have seen the souls, young women with their souls ripped out that have been molested. I've been to rehab events where every woman in there said they'd been molested as a child. I've been in the women's prison and in the youth prisons, all those girls have been molested as children. And for you to complain about being on the list doesn't compare to that, compared to the suffering those people went through. And I mean, I mean, you kind of outrage me over that. It's just such a horrific crime that does so much damage. And these girls that are prostitutes, many of them, that's where they got sidetracked, was they were molested by, and you're right, not by the stranger, but by the uncle or the family friend. They're the people, the girls that are drugged out. It's they have this horrific incident happen, which is not just a one-time deal, and maybe it was a one-time deal for the offender. I question that we don't catch him. But that is so horrific. And again, whether we're talking about the registration or not, it's a different subject. But it is that is a horrific crime, and it, I'm not very sympathetic to somebody complaining about being on the list. If you could, I guess you could probably tell that. Representative Stark, please.
All right. Thank you, Chair Barker. Question for you, Professor, in just a moment. I'm somewhat discouraged that this conversation has gone so far beyond the bill into the registry. Most of the testimony seems to be about the registry, and then recidivism rates for sex offenders in general. But this bill is pretty specific to trafficking children and compelling prostitution. And so when we talk about, you know, the 94% are a close family member, well, most of the time, those are not the trafficking cases. So the other 6% right. are pretty important when it applies to this bill.
That's very true.
You know, I've worked with children in residential treatment that have been trafficked by both family and non-family, picked up by strangers in the park, and there's specific cases that I know their lives, and I saw the misery and destruction of their lives. I guess the profession, or the question for you, Professor, is recidivism rates, if you know, when it comes to that other 6%, those who have committed the crime of trafficking and compelling prostitution, how often do we see that they reoffend in sex offending later?
I don't know of any studies that look at that. I'm sorry, Representative Stark. And I would like to say that to echo your concerns and Chair Barker's concerns, I have a niece who was one of the young women who was raped at University of Montana, and these are hard decisions. I think, though, that what we want to, the ball we want to keep our eye on is how do we prevent new crimes from occurring, and I think I would always argue that the evidence-based practices are our best way to try to move forward on that.
Yeah, thank you, Professor. Any further questions? Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2218 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2360.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2360 modifies the crime of failure to report as a sex offender by triggering the obligation to report following a change of residence. There's a -1 amendment for you that adds an emergency clause to the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Knott and Gail Meyer, please. Representative Aaron Knott and Gail Meyer.
Whoa, representative now.
A promotion.
I didn't want to demote him. Yeah.
Is that a promotion or a?
We're going to pay him.
Well, depends on
whether you're talking about pay or whether you're talking about title.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I have to ask some salary-related questions before I sign up for
Don't
this.
Don't do it, Aaron.
I'm Aaron Knott. I am the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice here in support of House Bill 2360. House Bill 2360 is not about the registry side of failure to report as a sex offender. It's about an enforcement issue. And I hesitate to call it a technical fix because we've called it that before, and that's some of the reason that we are here today. So I started getting calls late in 2015 from initially from sheriffs in Southern Oregon, then later from the state police, and finally from DOJ itself, stating that a recent Court of Appeals decision had badly impaired the ability of our law enforcement to make arrests for failure to report as a sex offender. That case is State v. Heiner, which came down from the Court of Appeals in 2015. And to understand Heiner and the reason for 2360, I'll have to ask for your patience in taking you back to yet another case decided in 2008, State v. McNabb. State v. McNabb basically said there it was a failure to register as a sex offender case where they were able to say, okay, this defendant was in this county a year before he got hit with this charge and then just after, but we're not sure where he was at the time. And the court held venue is a constitutional issue here in Oregon, and the court held that venue hadn't been established. So in response, this committee, House Judiciary, initiated and then subsequently passed House Bill 2171, which changed what had been the old language, saying the obligation to report as a sex offender is triggered if you move to a, if you fail to report following a change of residence, which had been the law, to you move to a new residence and fail to report the move and the person's new address. This was an attempt to provide venue both in the place where you were and the place where you potentially ended up. And the decision that came down in Heiner relies very heavily on legislative history, so much so that I think it's a good moment to remember to our horror that anything that any of us say in this committee or on the floor will end up in these opinions sometimes. It's always sort of a bracing moment when it happens. And this ruling basically imposed on the state the obligation to demonstrate beyond a reasonable doubt not just that a person had left a residence, but that they had acquired a new one. That is a tremendous problem. It works very well for somebody who sells their house or registers a new apartment, but it absolutely fails to address somebody who moves in with a girlfriend, somebody who moves in with a boyfriend, moves into their mother's basement, or the most obvious fact pattern, someone who simply does not have a permanent residence. They're moving from shelter to shelter or even bridge to bridge. And so this bill, 2360, is one of three. There was another bill introduced by the sheriffs that I think is word for word the same, and then a third introduced by the state police, all of them desperate for a fix that will allow for the routine enforcement of failure to register as a sex offender. So we pulled a group together. It included law enforcement, the district attorneys, OJD, OCDLA, committee counsel NASB. And we noodled on this for a while, and we basically decided on what we think is the simplest fix, which is to go back to the law the way it was in 2009. Now, there are failure to register as a sex offender is an extremely difficult charge. Venue is very hard. That issue I raised with the homeless or houseless population, that's a very real one. And that's a problem that law enforcement is going to continue to have. But I think law enforcement would tell you, and Kevin Campbell authorized me to say this, and I think he's going to waive, that they are experiencing real hardships on the ground. The boots on the ground perspective on this is that we're in a lot of trouble. So this is a consensus tweak. I think all parties are on board with it. It will not solve every issue here, but it will allow for us to go back to the normal course of doing business. The Dash 1 amendment, I do want to explain, we are adding an emergency clause. We did not ask for one initially, but given the gravity of what has happened on the ground, I believe it's appropriate.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are neutral on the bill. We understood one thing that's so great about dealing with Mr. Knott and the DOJ is what President Knott is that when they think they need to do a bill, they call the stakeholders up and they convene a meeting and we sit and we talk. And it's by and through the exchange you get to the point where you go, oh, okay, I guess we can live with that. So that's where we are. We understood the problem. We understand the need for the fix. We think the fix is targeted to the problem. We're neutral on the bill. And we say thank you to Mr. Knott, President Knott, for allowing us to have the discussion.
Okay. Are there any questions? I'm not going to move the bill today. There's been some concern in the committee. We want to try to take one more look so that somebody that's homeless isn't just getting cycled through over and over again with a...
Chair Barker, could I remark briefly on that? That was something that our group actually discussed, I think, more than anything else. And there is an amenability in that group. And I've had this discussion with Mr. Nasby about continuing that conversation. The thing is, that conversation is very hard. There are constitutionality questions that... And we had, I think, the right people in the room to try to brainstorm. And we're mindful of the legislative timeline, but we are willing to reconvene if you would like us to do so.
I expect a short time to try to come up with some resolution of that because that's been cited. And then because I do want to move the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, right, Representative Vile.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Aaron, I should have asked you this the other day when you were in my office and I just didn't think about it at the time, but is there anywhere that we define residence for these purposes?
So, Chair Barker, Representative Vile, that question was actually also very much brought up during our work group because one of the proposals was potentially modifying the definition of residence to expand it so that it would come closer to non-conventional forms of residence like a camp or some sort of an outpost. I think there were objections to that I'll let Ms. Meyer, I think she'll be willing to outline, and I'd invite committee counsel, if he has it present, to share the definition of residence. I do not have it.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I'm thinking about the definition of residence in this case is because really the purpose is to give people an idea of where someone is, and that's not necessarily the definition of residence for a whole bunch of other purposes in the law. So any help I can get in feeling comfortable that we've accomplished that is going to be good toward moving.
We'll take a quick look at that as well. Thank you. And somebody represent the post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Aaron, Representative Knott, I just think I want to thank you if you would do it one more time, because I think you'll do a great service for me in my grand crusade to end the emergency clause. You're putting it on because there is an emergency. Mm-hmm. If I heard you right, I mean, could you real quickly just a quick description of the emergency? Because I think you said it, didn't you?
Chair Barker, Representative Post, it's my belief that House Bill 2360 is trying to address a real barrier to the enforcement of this criminal provision that's making it hard for us to maintain the enforcement of the registry. I do characterize that as an emergency.
Okay. That's so important. And I want people from whoever might be listening at some point to hear the description of an emergency. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Post. Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2360 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2409.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2409 authorizes cities to operate cameras and sensors to record drivers who speed in excess of 10 miles over the limit, requires the city to notify community and the drivers of the use of the technology. The bill requires police officers to review the photograph and sensor data before issuing a citation, and much like the bill we heard on Monday, the bill provides registered owners of the vehicles to whom the citation is issued with the ability to submit a certificate of innocence or a certificate of non-liability. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and Vice Chairs and members of the committee here. My name is Jim Monger. I'm the Chief of Police with the Beaverton Police Department, and I'm here to talk about House Bill 2409 and urge your support of this. The City of Beaverton is very proud of the supporters that we have for this House bill, and they include the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, Street Trust, and also Oregon Walks. The City of Beaverton, we're very committed to any efforts to decrease the likelihood of any fatalities or serious injuries that might occur from vehicle crashes. A 2000 study from the U.S. Department of Transportation indicated that the chances of serious injury or fatalities increase by 40 to 80% for a vehicle that's traveling at 10 miles an hour over 30 miles an hour posted speed limit. What this basically boils down to is the faster a collision, the more likelihood of a fatality or a serious injury. Over the last year, more than 90,000 trips through Beaverton's four red light cameras were in excess of 10 miles an hour over the posted limit as far as the speed limit approaching those intersections. And again, that's 90,000 of those that are above the 10 amount. Not just 1 or 2 miles, this is starting at the 10 mile an hour limit and then going up from there, and that's 90,000. And that is that creates a significant danger for other vehicles, drivers, pedestrians, bicyclists, anyone that's at that intersection. The more speed a person carries into the intersection, more likelihood that there is going to be a fatality if there is a collision. The danger of the speeds at these intersections is the same whether the light is red, whether it's green, or whether it's yellow. It really doesn't matter as far as the light phase if a collision were to occur. In reviewing the initial warning period of the speed safety cameras that Portland has installed, the Portland Bureau of Transportation observed a 93.5% reduction in excessive speeding during their educational period and during their warning periods. That's a fabulous reduction. People are slowing down, and when people slow down, lives are saved. So I'm very happy that Portland is doing that. I'm very pleased with those results. Currently, the ability to issue citations through the red light statutes is limited to showing that violation by the camera alone. The speed sensors aren't part of the issuance of any citations. It's just the camera system itself. The photo radar statutes, they focus on the speeding, and they are not allowed to cover the red light systems. And this kind of creates a gap where we have a system that can monitor red lights and a system that can monitor speeding from photo radar vans, but there's a gap of combining these two technologies together. The House bill that is before you now is requesting that the intersections that are equipped with the red light technology be allowed to also issue citations for excessive speeding coming into those intersections. The technology at the intersections now, with the loops that we have, registered those speeds. And so we're able to determine what the speeds are of those vehicles coming through. And that technology was able to give us that count of that 90,000 vehicles through our just four intersections that we have in Beaverton. The technology for the photo radar has improved to the point where the technology at these locations would have a plus or minus accuracy of 1 mile per hour. So it is very, it's the same technology as far as from a photo radar van, which is a proven technology and accepted in the courts. The having this system is, it gives us the opportunity, along with a robust public education campaign, that we can combine the citations with this educational campaign to encourage people to change their behavior, to slow down. And I actually anticipate that, and I don't have the data to share on this, that as people become aware that these intersections are being monitored and citations for speed are being issued, that people will slow down prior to coming to these intersections. And I anticipate actually a drop in the citations for red light violations, because as people come to these intersections, they're slowing down, they're more cautious, they're aware of it, and when the light does cycle to the yellow phase, of which all of the intersections in Beaverton meet or exceed the state and the federal standards, that these people are going to be able to stop well before going into that intersection. When I was very new in law enforcement, one of the very first citations that I wrote for going through a red light, and the defendant, his defense was that he didn't have time to stop. And the judge, I took this to heart, and I used this throughout the rest of my career, and in my own personal driving, is that if you're driving in down the road and you see a traffic light that's green, and it's been green for a while, you need to anticipate that that light is going to change. And you need to look for pedestrians, and you need to watch the walk, don't walk, and anticipate it and slow down before you get to that intersection. And that's what I hope that this this proposal will do, this House bill will do. It's not about the trying to issue more citations. Frankly, I wish that there were no citations. If we could set these things up and had zeros, that's a success, but that's just not what we have right now. A concern also is perhaps someone that is approaching the intersection, as with the current technology, and the light changes to the yellow phase. And I know that yellow means stop, although we have many motorists who believe yellow means gun it to beat that red. And right now, when they gun it, they do beat the red, because they have entered the intersection before that light cycles and before the red light technology will detect that. However, this is a driver who is now accelerating into congested areas, and they're actually creating more risk there. So encouraging these people to slow down is definitely a goal of this House bill. So to wrap that up, this is about safety. This is about slowing people down. This is about saving lives, reducing injuries. And I urge your support of this House bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Chief, so Representative Olson, our old state, you know.
You have that look. Sir. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, I like that.
That is a compliment.
Okay. One of the things policies we had was we didn't double barrel people. One ticket, you know, even though they had done a couple things, we'd write one citation. And so in this case, it could be either speeding or red light, or sometimes both at the same time. And I would ask, would it be possible if we were to clarify that you get one citation? I mean, the courts would know that you also were speeding when you ran the red light, but rather than a red light and a speeding ticket for the same thing. I mean, if you're speeding through the light and it's green and you get the speeding ticket, that's fine. But rather than not double barrel people, how would you feel about that?
Well, and that was one thing, Chair, that I first saw this, that was my initial concern was, and so we're going to issue citations that we had for the red light violation. And then someone who is going, as an example, 10 miles an hour over, we're going to be issuing a second citation there. And there's varying thoughts on that. One is that the speed that you're carrying and you're speeding towards the intersection is a contributing factor to your going through the red light. And as you alluded to, I think that there is a difference as far as the phasing color of the light. if this is, as an example, this is just a red light and people are speeding through, I think that's its own separate issue, and that's the technology of basically a photo radar at that location looking for speed. As far as the red light, the way that the bill is written now, it is a policy decision for the individual agency to decide if they're going to issue for both. Okay. I personally do have a concern as far as issuing a red light violation, which I believe is the more serious of those. However, you know, the 10 mile an hour seems to almost be stacking on and doesn't seem to be in keeping as far as with the safety. However, having the option for both, and if you have someone who has blown the red light and they get that citation and they're traveling into the intersection at 20 or 30 miles an hour more, I think that's a situation where to change this person's behavior, two citations, I think, in those situations would be more appropriate.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's a good explanation. Are there any other questions, Representative Vile?
Just one real quick, Chief. Are the calibration intervals on this technology the same for the red, the yellow-red, and the speed calibrations?
Representative, yes, they are. So the technology that the photo red light has right now, there's several different ones. One would be just the loops that are in the ground. The vehicle hits the first loop and then the second loop, and that has an accuracy of about plus minus 2.5 miles per hour. More accurately would be a sensor for a tire strike, so like the old gas station, for those of you that remember those. You hit the pneumatic tube and the bell goes off, and that is more precise, and that technology is down to 1 mile an hour plus or minus. The system that we would have in Beaverton, I was talking with the company that supplies the equipment for us, that it would be upgraded to a mapping radar, and that would also be the plus minus 1 mile per hour, which is the same calibration, same technology as the photo radar bands.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Sure, please. I
was actually asking about how often you are checking to make sure that your calibrations are kept within the tolerances. And I know you have to do it every so often for the red lights. I'm guessing that you would want to make sure that you'd kept these on a similar interval so that you were always accurate with both at the same time. Is that a good assumption?
Representative Vile and Chair Barker, yes. For the speed measuring devices that we own for the Beaverton Police Department, they're calibrated and tested annually.
And both those pieces would be done at the same time?
I need to confirm that they would be, because this is actually, the technology is owned by another company, but I would need to make sure and get back to the committee as far as the frequency of that. You make an excellent point, and the preference would be that with any other speed measuring devices that the city would deploy, that it would be calibrated at a minimum at that same interval.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
So I guess, Chief, I'm interested in spinning off a little bit about what Chair Barker was sharing, too. I have a real concern with having two citations issued to an individual that are related. I mean, both of them being hazardous violations, HVs. My question to you is, how do you see this fitting in then, okay, with, it's 811-109, but it deals with the penalty of speed violations. This is the piece where we moved forward years ago, that if you're 30 miles per hour over the speed limit, that the court may suspend your driver's license for 30 days. So I'm just kind of curious your take on that, too.
I think that would be one that if a person is driving at that excessive speed at this particular location, most likely they're carrying that behavior elsewhere. I have not specifically considered whether or not we would look at issuing that particular citation, which would trigger a suspension. However, that is extremely dangerous driving, especially at an intersection. And my initial thought is, yes, I would entertain issuing that citation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Barker. So a couple questions, so you can kind of fire away on all of them. One of them is, this is a new conversation for me. So, and I get the redundancy would be annoying, but is there anything that would keep you right now from placing one of the vans, you know, that take the pictures near one of these lights that are such a major problem? So that's one question, you know, and I get that, you know, using one set of technology to do something is more ideal. Another is, I'm curious how many cities currently have the technology in place, because as you read this, it's specific about what type of lights and so forth. How many cities throughout Oregon have the technology in place to do this? And the extra $14 million that would be generated off of this, if you only cited for the violation of the speeding, the excessive speed. So if you didn't do red light, but the 90,000 occurrences at $160 each, $14.4 million, where does that go? Sorry to stack all those questions there, but.
Well, Representative Stewart, Chair Barker, thank you very much, and I jotted them down in order, so I'll be able to address those. Right. First, as far as the location in the van, typically the intersections where the photo red light is located, there's not a location nearby to actually put the van that would have a clear view of those lanes of travel. Typically, the intersections that I'm thinking of right now, the very first one close to the City Hall building, is by a Fred Meyer, and just the congestion there, there's just not an area to park a van safely without blocking a sidewalk or blocking a lane of traffic. So it could be done, but we'd have to create additional parking pads and things like that for that particular period.
Quick follow-up on that specific question, Chair. So statutorily, there's nothing that would prevent you from doing that, though, that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. I would have to do a little bit more research, but I don't believe that there is any prohibition from having photo red light enforcement and photo speed enforcement at the same location. Is that correct to your question?
Yes.
Okay. We'll check into that.
Representative Sprinkle, did you have a question?
Well, yeah,
okay, please. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions, but Representative Olson went there, and I have to say, I didn't have to be a state trooper. I got to be a deputy, and so that was pretty cool. Didn't have to, anyway, I'll leave that alone. So there could be, as I go through the bill, there's no limit that this would just be a citation on and or red light and speed. You could end up with a careless driving citation out of the behavior that you would see if the speed and the light.
Representative and Chair Parker, no, this is specific to a red light violation or the speeding violation. So the other violations that might be captured as far as distracted driving, expired license plates, and those type of things, this is very narrow to adding speed enforcement at the locations, at these intersections with the photo red light.
Another question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you alluded to it, but I'm not sure. How did you decide on the 10-mile-an-hour over language?
Thank you for the question. The decision for the 10-mile-an-hour over is consistent with the current law as far as the violation level. The idea of issuing a citation for someone traveling at a lower speed at 9 or 8 miles an hour, frankly, I think that you'd be really hard pressed to find a police officer, even a state trooper,
yes,
that would, mm-hmm, or a deputy, that would issue a citation for that minimum amount. Just normal driving through city, it is not uncommon to have your speed creep up a little bit.
Yep.
Technically, you're violating the traffic law, but is it reasonable to issue a citation? So it kind of gets to that reasonableness and that threshold of you're looking at double digits above the posted speed limit, and that's why that particular number was selected.
Okay, thank you, Representative Burson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Working at Portland, the common standard was 10 over, so I really like the 10 over. But I did want to ask you, or just to clarify something, we, until the city council removed it, we had red light cameras in Fairview at a particularly dangerous intersection, and they took them out. It's a whole other story. But what their standard was that the chief or one of his officers would always then, as we've talked about, evaluate the tickets. But they didn't always issue tickets, even though you'd gotten somebody on the camera. Is that what you anticipate here?
Representative Gorsuch and Chair Barker, yes. We want to ensure that when the citations, when they are viewed, there'll be some criteria as far as if for some reason the technology picked up something that's actually 9, well, we're not going to do that. So there is that independent decision from a human to say, I have viewed this violation, and I, as a human, am making a decision to issue that citation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, Chief, no more questions. I think what we're going to do is take a look at a quick amendment that will say if it's 20 over 2 citations.
Okay. And Chair Barker, if I could, I think there were some follow-up questions that I didn't get to questions 2 through 20, I believe, over on this.
2 through 20?
So it would say may also. Would give the still, yeah. We wouldn't require 2, but we would sort of prevent 2 until they get 20 over, which, and I just will say in Beaverton, where I'm my home ground there, when they first put those red light cameras in, I saw them going off all the time. I rarely see that anymore because people do know people are driving much safer than they did when those were first installed. I think those have saved a lot of people from accidents, if not worse.
Thank you. And for your question number 2, the 90,000 citations, and either you're good up here or you had your iPhone out and you did the math real quick as far as what the citation would be. So the 90,000 citations or the 90,000 violations that I was talking about in the last year through the 4 intersections that we have, if we look at what happened with Portland and their reduction by 93% during the educational period and the written warnings, I anticipate that 90,000, if it drops by 90%, then you're looking at a total number of citations of more of 9,000, probably less than that. As far as the dollar amounts for that, it would go into the city's general fund, of which others would decide what that's spent for.
Okay, great. Well, yep. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chief.
Thank Appreciate you very much.
Testimony. Anything further to come before the committee? I'll adjourn.
Thank you very much.
Testimony. Anything further to come before the committee?